This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Elvis Costello helped revitalize rock and roll in the late 70s. My guest, Bruce Thomas, played behind him with a propulsive beat. Thomas was the bass player in Costello's backup band, The Attractions. Thomas joined in 1977, just after Costello recorded his first album, My Aim Is True, and he stayed with Costello for 10 years. Life on the Road is the subject of Bruce Thomas's new book, The Big Wheel, Rock and Roll and Roadside Attractions. Let's hear something from the first album Thomas recorded with Costello, This Year's Model. This is Radio Radio.
I was chilling in the shine of the light, not dialed to it, and then my radio advised. With every one of those late night stations playing songs, bringing tears to my eyes. I was seriously thinking about hiding the receiver when the switch broke, cause it's old. They're saying things that I can hardly believe. They really think we're getting out of control. Radio is a sound salvation. Radio is cleaning up the nation. They say you better listen.
Elvis Costello's Radio Radio with Bruce Thomas featured on bass. Thomas's memoir about life on the road isn't a very gossipy book. In fact, he doesn't even refer to the people in the band by name. Elvis Costello is referred to as the singer. Band member Steve Naive is called keyboard player. Pete Thomas is referred to only as drummer. This gives the story something of a generic quality, which is what Thomas wanted.
There's a slight unreality to touring when you're in a capsule that you do actually, you know, after the first couple of tours, when you've spent, we once spent 44 hours driving from Seattle to Madison, Wisconsin. And by the time we'd done the first, 42 hours, we knew everything about each other, inside and outside, life history, the lot. So after that, there's very little that can be exchanged on that level. I guess it's like guys that's that spend a lot of time in a trench in the war or something. It's you exchange all the kind of information and facts, and then it kind of gets a little bit abstract after that, and you don't really think of each other by your names anymore. You are characters. And the other thing is, it is generic. There are probably, bands on tour around America at the moment, who are maybe got a copy of the book, and they'll be sitting there thinking, God, it's just like that. He really knows, he really knows what he's talking about. It's just like this on the road. And so drummer, singer and anything is really any drummer or singer. It's pretty interchangeable once you get on the road. It's nothing to do with personalities and people, because touring is a pretty depersonalizing kind of activity.
Can you compare what your attitude was toward being on the road when you started being on the road to when you ended?
excuse me while I laugh. I think the first two or three years, it was pretty exciting. It was also kind of burnout time as well, because we had about 5 days off in the first couple of years, and we really actually overdid it, I think. We just took on a really over-the-top work schedule and kind of fried ourselves and lost it a bit, towards the end of it. But it was nonetheless, it was really, I listened to some of the bootlegs and so forth done at, random live gigs somewhere in upstate, nowhere in the middle of America somewhere, that we've been playing, night after night after night. And it's quite frightening to hear the kind of intensity that we're going at it with. I thought we were doing that every night, and driving 600 miles and doing it every night for two or three, 4 years. I just, it makes me wonder where it all came from or how I'm still kind of, even sane. But towards the end, of course, that workload tailed off, and then the hotels got bigger and we got separate rooms, and we kind of, would send the wine back and the usual kind of stuff, and it all got a little bit sloppy and squidgy around the edges. Also, I think, there was a certain alienation between Elvis and the rest of the band. I think he was obviously thinking about he couldn't work with the Attractions forever, but it was kind of manifesting really in his general attitude to us and so forth. I think where we'd once been an asset, he was thinking of us as a liability. So it kind of got a little bit uncomfortable towards the end, and it was a kind of natural thing that it broke up, really.
So when you left Elvis Costello in 1987, was that because he was ready to find new musicians, or is it because you were ready to leave, or some?
Well, it was both, but he'd already found other musicians, and he did an album called King of America with American session musicians, in which we played on one track. But it kind of, his behaviour during that recording period was a little bit peculiar, in as much as we were. Yeah, the whole project was set up, was talked about in London. I said, well, what's the point of us going, you know, we're going to be waiting like on the bench, like a hockey team, you know, ready to come on or what, you
right.
know? I mean, which is a bit peculiar. We'd done, you know, after doing 12 albums and about 40-some tours, I did think we kind of deserve slightly better treatment than that kind of thing. But anyway, we went, I said, well, you know, we got one shot at each song, you know, like first take job, Bob Dylan kind of stuff. And we managed to sort of make the grade for one song, which is a bit much kind of auditioning for the guy you've been working with for 10 years. But and then we went down the next day. I went down with Pete and down to the studio, and there's the whole studio was cleared of equipment. And I said to Pete, well, I guess that means we're through for this one, you know. So we did about one day's work on that album, rattled through all the songs, got one first time, and kind of that was it, you know. So after that, I basically hung on, and I just stayed in Los Angeles for 3 weeks and let Elvis collect the bill and so forth like that, because I thought, well, you know, I'm not going to start kind of having a fist fight with him, but I shall, you know, I shall try and kind of even the score a bit, because I did feel a little bit hard done by.
My guess is Bruce Thomas, and from 1977 to 87, he was with Elvis Costello's band, The Attractions, and he's written a new book about life on the road called The Big Wheel. Would you tell the story of how you became the bass player with Elvis Costello?
I read an ad in a music paper called The Melody Maker. I think it said, bass player wanted for rocking pop combo. I had half an idea that it was Elvis Costello who was advertising. He'd just done a few kind of solo gigs around town and was making a bit of a name for himself. And I thought this could be the general kind of consensus, reading between the lines, that was that he was going to be the next big thing to come out of England. So I thought, well, this could be a bit of a good gig to be on board. So I applied for the job and got a time to go down to a rehearsal studio for the audition. So I realised he'd had two or three singles out, done with, I think it was an American backing group called Clover, who'd actually backed him up on his early recording sessions. So I went out and bought, I think, two or three singles and spent a couple of days learning them. And then I went down to the audition and let Elvis play a few songs to me, and as if I'd heard them for the first time, and kind of stumbled through them for a verse or two, and then played them note perfectly by the end. So I did use a bit of a con trick, except he did play me a couple of songs I hadn't heard at all, and I pretended I was going to try some radical new approach, like one note bass line all the way through or something. But anyway, it basically did the trick, so yeah, my little psychological ploy worked.
Did you have a different attitude on stage with Elvis Costello than you'd had with previous bands that you'd played with?
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously it was much more intense, the Elvis stuff, you know, and it wasn't entirely natural energy that was fueling that band, I must say.
But a lot of drugs and alcohol?
Well, there's a lot of vodka and what one might call Peruvian hay fever powder or something.
Was that? Did you feel like at the time that was a good energy you were getting? That, I mean, did that drive the band in a good way?
Yeah, it wasn't totally neurotic and kind of other substance fueled. I mean, I think the energy was there. I mean, in fact, the energy was there. What we tended to do was push it over the top into something beyond energy. Where, in fact, I mean, for a good example, is we used to have an hour and a quarter stage show. written out on paper, which we would play pretty kind of bang, bang, bang. You know, I mean, there wasn't kind of more than a couple of seconds between songs, and sometimes the songs would run into each other three, four, five, or six at a time, you know, and we'd whip through this stuff at a fair old lick. But we actually, by the time we'd had a bit of an aperitif before the gig, we'd end up doing this set in about 40, 45 minutes. And we did that at I don't think it was Winterland. There's some gig in San Francisco that Bill Graham, the famous promoter, was doing. And we actually finished the set in 45 minutes and we didn't know any more songs, you know. And there were to us like people wanting their money back and so forth, as you might imagine. I mean, if we'd have slowed down and played it at the normal rate, it would have been fine. And we had a similar problem at Santa Monica Civic Auditorium, I think, where we ripped through the set that was supposed to last about an hour and a quarter in 40 minutes, and there was, you know, smoke bombs going on stage and the rest of it, and so we basically went back on stage and trashed the gear for an encore, and you know, I thought, well, this is the kind of stuff that rock and roll myths are made of, isn't it, really? So
it's an expensive encore, though, isn't it?
Well, funnily enough, actually, it wasn't our equipment.
Oh, that's nice. Whose was it?
I don't know. I think it might have been hired, but we probably lost money on that gig too. But there you go. That's the way to do it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bruce Thomas, and from 1977 to 87, he was the bass player with Elvis Costello, and he's written a book about life on the road called The Big Wheel. We're going to take a short break, and we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Bruce Thomas is my guest, and he's written a new book about life on the road with Elvis Costello and the Attractions. Elvis Costello writes a lot of really obscure rock lyrics, you know, where you kind of get what it's about, but you're not really sure. And, like, there are images that are very interesting, but they don't necessarily make any literal sense to you. Did you ever say to him, what is the song really about? I mean, what exactly do you mean here?
Some of it I knew where it came from because I was there when he wrote it down, when he'd seen a street sign or something. But the particular combination that a lot of these lyrics were put into still remains obscure to me, I must admit. Some of it I could see. I mean, I'd have to literally probably sit and go through some of the lyrics and maybe I could kind of identify some of the meanings of things. But I think a lot of the time it is just... it's just the sound of the words and a pun for a pun's sake, and you know, where there's actually no real meaning to it. It's kind of like how would you say it? You know, it's frenetic poetry or something.
Yeah,
we're making a word salad. And I always said to Elvis, why are you scared of being simple? You know, just try and write one song like Buddy Holly or something. But never really managed it.
Can you maybe give us a sense of how you would rehearse a new song and figure out an arrangement for it?
Well, I guess it's never the same twice, but I mean, sometimes Elvis would just come along and sing a song and play it with an acoustic guitar and maybe suggest a particular direction it would want to go in, and then we'd just sort of think out loud, more or less. You know, there'd be somebody who'd, you know, start a basic drum pattern and figure out the chords and start working out rough, harmonies and riffs and passing notes. And then, you know, perhaps we need a break here. The drum should build up for two bars, you know, starting from nothing on eights. Or perhaps we need to put a little phrase in here. Or
let me ask you specifically about the first record. Do you remember how Pump It Up came together?
Yeah, it came up very quickly. That was a song. The da 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 riff is stolen from Neat 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 by the Damned, and then the other, it's kind of easy to explain this because it's basically written around the bass line. It was all on one chord originally. The bass line is a cross between You've Got to Lose by Richard Hell and the Voidoids, played in the rhythm of The Price of Love by the Everly Brothers, with a bar of You've Really Got Me tagged on the end of it. So it's like a hybrid bass line of three other bass riffs. And, once we got the two riffs and the two chords, we blasted through it. And in fact, Pump It Up was the first and only time we recorded it. It's a first take recording. We decided what we were going to do, played it, and that was the record. So that was an easy one.
Let me play some of that. And this is from Elvis Costello's second album, the first album that bass player Bruce Thomas was featured on. Here's Pump It Up. Typical in arrangements with the Attractions to kind of cop riffs from different records that you like?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you could probably again go through some of the albums and say where things were stolen from, but it's not just a matter of plagiarism or stealing things. It's a kind of a constant recycling of certain sort of themes in a way that kind of there are certain things, it already sounds like a record because you've sort of heard it before, you know. It's not lack of ideas, because it's putting things, taking things down to pieces and putting them together in combinations that they maybe wouldn't exist in normally, you know.
In your new book about being on the road, The Big Wheel, you write that you might have called the singer Kurt Reply, but we simply called him The Pod.
Oh, dear.
So what was it about Elvis Costello that could have been named by Kurt Reply, and why did you call him The Pod?
Well, in fact, we used to have these nicknames all the time, and he did, in fact, of his own volition, buy one of, you know, those name badges that they sell in truck stops and so forth, you know, that say Sherilyn or whatever, Naomi and Peregrine. He bought one that said Kurt to wear on his lapel, because he was actually quite proud of the fact that he would give journalists a Kurt reply when they approached him. And so everybody had all these nicknames, based on similar laboured puns and so forth. But when our sort of respect had worn a bit thin, we used to call him The Pod, because he did used to like eating a fair amount, and as the years wore on, he got slightly more oval shaped than when he was a new age whiz kid, and the pods were these things in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where the aliens descended to Earth, and a bit like those things in Spinal Tap, you know, that the band gets stuck in, and we thought he'd got a bit pod shaped, so that's how it came about.
Did you call him Elvis or Declan?
We didn't call. I think we called him EC, actually, or L. But never Declan, no. That was we never knew him as Declan, even when he tried to, you know, change his name back and anything. It was always L, or Elvoid, I think. Was often the...
Why not the full Elvis?
Sorry? That's for other people to do. You've got to have, you've got to always slightly have, all bands have a band language that nobody else can fathom out at all, you know, so you can talk to yourself amongst yourselves, so you can basically say, this person's a drag, or, are you interested in her, or such and such a thing, so that nobody else can figure out what you're talking about. So you have all these coded ways of talking, really, that any you know, you find it where any group of people work together, they start developing a private language, you know.
In your book, you write, we carried on like nouveau riche brats. What kind of behavior were you thinking of when you wrote that?
That's when we used to go to restaurants and treat waiters badly and order huge meals that cost hundreds of dollars and drink 150-year-old bottles of wine, you know, and 100-year-old bottles of brandy and dump it in the coffee and so forth, you know. It was just, I mean, for a while we just had more money than sense, really, and in fact we did. We just didn't have any other outlet. I mean, we were on the road all the time, you know, and we'd all got our American Express gold cards, so there was nowhere else to go but to restaurants and spend money, you know, for a bit. And I guess, you know, I was just thinking the other day, I thought, God, I'm the sort of person that I would hate to meet myself on a plane as I was 10 years ago. That's basically what I'm trying to say. I mean, if I went to a restaurant and the 10 years earlier version of me walked in, I think I'd leave, you know, or any of us. You know, we must have just made life so miserable for people.
How did you outgrow that?
I outgrow it by spending the money and by basically you just can't go on living like that because it's boring, you know. It's like fun for a couple of years, you know, for anybody to, you know, everybody has a little brattish period for a while. I mean, some people may never get through it and they just become undignified and sad, but it's all right. I mean, it's another aspect of life. If you want to be a well-rounded person, you've got to do a bit of everything. So I suppose being a brat for a year or so is not going to do too much harm. But I think as long as you realise, it's when you really just lose yourself in a role and become so identified with it, you can't see you're just, you know, experimenting with life or experience another aspect of it. You know, I mean, I know what it's like to have nothing at all. So, I mean, I just thought I'd see what it was like to carry on like a brat. There probably wasn't that quite that objective about it, but I mean, fortunately, there's always a thread of something there that says, well, this isn't really, you know, your way of life or how you're meant to be. This is just another phase of life.
Bruce Thomas. He was the bass player for Elvis Costello's band for 10 years. Thomas has written a book about life on the road called The Big Wheel, Rock and Roll and Roadside Attractions. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.